You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. This week, we're talking about physician and provider burnout in the medical field and other areas of healthcare. And I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. Sean Jones to inform this very important conversation. Dr. Jones is an ear, nose, and throat physician and head and neck surgeon who is a founding member of his specialty group, Purchase ENT, and a member of the Gratis faculty at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. Dr. Jones served on active duty in Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and as a captain in the Medical Corp, and has served in multiple medical mission trips in countries around the globe. Dr. Jones's book, Finding Heart in Art, addresses the growing problem of burnout in medicine, with over 50% of physicians experiencing burnout. Dr. Jones shares his own story about burnout early in his medical career and how he discovered an avenue to heal this. Dr. Jones, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So you wrote this book, Finding Heart in Art, A Surgeon's Renaissance Approach to Healing Modern Medical Burnout. What prompted you to write the book?
Well, I actually was shaving one morning and sort of recognized that I was emotionally absent. And I can remember looking in the mirror, and it was sort of an epiphany that I came to that recognition. But I did what a lot of really highly trained medical specialists would do, and I ignored it. Hoped it would go away because it scared me to death. And fortunately for me, my wife recognized, I think, my lack of emotion and sent me to my internist to get a head CT. And so there's actually a little part of the book that talks about me going to my internist and, saying, hey, I need a head CT. And he goes, well, what should I put down as the reason? And I was sort of like, well, how about if I said I had the worst headache I've ever had? And so we got a head CT. And of course, it was completely normal. But through that process, I ended up getting some counseling and discovered that I was actually suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder-related depression, which was a subsequent as a result of burnout. And so really taking some time off and getting the help I needed and sort of coming to terms with that. And I was able to come back to medicine and my surgical practice without, you know, any type of antidepressants or medication or anything like that, just reconnecting in a sense with myself and my humanity in a way that I'd sort of gotten separated from as a result of practicing for that period of time. So subsequent to that, I felt like there might be some benefit to someone recognizing those symptoms in themselves and maybe getting help before I did and avoiding a lot of the consequences that can come even later from burnout, which I think a lot of us are really familiar with.
Yes, so I would think a lot of people know or think they know what burnout is, but I'm curious to hear from you how it's defined, because I don't know if a lot of people would think that post-traumatic stress disorder is burnout. So right, how do you define it?
There's a little bit of an argument, but I mean argument in the best sense of the word, amongst medical professionals, some of which who don't believe that post-traumatic stress-related depression is related to burnout, that you're medicalizing burnout if you do that. But I think there's a continuum where if someone experiences burnout long enough, that work-related stress will sort of upend them into depression and other types of mental illness, if you will. So that, I think, is still to be worked out a bit. But I think the short definition is work-related stress. But the definition that is most often utilized when it comes to doing research on burnout was, I think, popularized by Christine Maslach, is emotional exhaustion which is I feel emotionally drained from my work. Working with people all day is really a strain for me, along with depersonalization, which is a tendency to become callous towards people. So that, you may worry that this job is sort of making you emotionally hardened. And then the final one is a loss of a sense of personal accomplishment, where you don't feel that like the job that you're doing matters or means anything anymore. And that's sort of in general the last step when you, if you're working in a job you really loved and find now that you don't get any meaning or satisfaction out of that job, then, you know, I think you really need to step back and look at that and see what's going on, because those would be the three things. Emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, a loss of accomplishment.
So, you know, yesterday I was walking through the halls of Cedars-Sinai Hospital, and I was thinking about the conversation we were going to have today, and I was looking at all the nurses in the nurses' station and the doctors, and, you know, and I started thinking about how much time do they have for self-care? How much time is there for exercise and self-care? And you know, there's kind of this culture of working hard, being hard, talking hard to each other. You know, there's kind of this tense energy, right? Especially in emergency rooms and hospitals. So how pervasive is physician burnout?
So,
or even medical professional burnout, right? Because they're the nurses and all the people sure. that the support system.
Because of my my bias or my focus, you might say in my work, I'm a little bit more familiar with the statistics on physician related burnout. But I've looked at the other ancillary and associated providers as well. And amongst physicians in 2013, if you go back to when we first started looking at burnout, the rates were in the high 30s. And in 1 year between 2013 and 2014, there was a significant increase in the level of burnout. And from the majority of physicians, it popped up over 50%, which was averaged about a 25% increase, depending on which study you look at, over 1 year. And despite the fact that we've sort of focused on burnout in certain respects over the last 7 or 8 years, we really haven't made a significant impact in reducing those numbers. It's been hovering in the high 40s to low 50s ever since. And depending on the specialty you look at, you mentioned emergency medicine, for example, they run one of the higher rates of burnout because of the severity of disease, the acute phase of illness they oftentimes deal with, and the fact that they aren't able to really select their patients. It's just whatever kind of walks in the door. So there's very little autonomy in a sense in their practice. Whereas a surgeon might say, well, I just do hernias and gallbladders, or I just do this. You can kind of pick what you want to do. Emergency medicine is different in that regard. But even some general surgical specialties will get up into the 60 or 70% range. So it kind of depends on specialty, but it's very pervasive. And for nurses, it's much the same. If you look at nurses in the ED or the intensive care unit, they'll have much higher rates of burnout than those who are on a surgical floor, for example, or a medical floor.
Right. And what are the key drivers or the causes of burnout amongst physicians?
There are probably about as many causes of burnout as there are causes of dizziness, if you're any, you know, familiar with that at all. So it could be, you know, literally anything, because when it comes to what is stressful, it can be different for you than it could be for someone else. But if you look at again, the statistics on it, call tends to be a significant stressor. So the more call that a physician takes, the greater their likelihood of burnout. The electronic health record has significantly added to burnout. And I have a lot of discussions with my friends in the IT departments at various hospitals, because I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about that. I don't feel like personally that the electronic health record in and of itself causes burnout, but the way in which we are forced to utilize the electronic health record and some of the bullet counting that's required for reimbursement and things like that really drive burnout to a large degree. And that relates to another whole segment of the causes of burnout, which is work that doesn't really matter when it comes to direct patient care. So if I'm required as a doctor to do these, what I consider to be menial, administrative, non-important issues that don't relate to patient care, but some administrative or regulatory body requires it, it tends to drive physicians crazy because we want to be doing meaningful, important work. And we don't like being told, you know, what to do in that. So non-value-added work is really important. And then relationships, aging kids, aging parents, kids that go off to college, kids that don't go off to college, you know, if they stay in the basement. And right. So that doesn't affect work in a sense. So that's not work-related stress, but those are individual factors that can predispose you to being more stressed at work. That makes sense.
Now, I would think, yeah, that makes total sense. I would think the electronic health record would decrease stress, right? That's what it should, if you think about it logically, right? It should be faster. It should be, you should be able to check boxes instead of write things out. You should be able to look up history much easier, but it's really interesting that you're saying it causes the opposite. Is that because of the regulatory and administrative functions within that?
I believe it is. And it's sort of a function. If you look at it, for example, it has made my life in the operating room a lot easier because I don't have to dictate every case. I can pre-template certain things. And, you know, if you want to metaphorically say, every time I do a neck dissection, I dig the ditch, I lay the pipe, I cover it with dirt, and I do the same thing the same way to try to get the same result. You know, I can do that in my operative reports. It works well. But on the other hand, the promise of the electronic health record was a sharing of data and information. But there's a hospital in my area that is on the same electronic health record system that my hospital system is on. And because the administrations are at each other's necks because of competitive reasons, I can't look at their x-rays. I can't look at their notes. There's a lot of information that could be shared that for whatever reason is not being shared. And so those things, as well as the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services at the federal level, and then you've got the layer of bureaucracy at the state level that do certain things. All of that, I think, makes the electronic health record more unwieldy than it needs to be.
Yeah, I've had a lot of experience with that firsthand, taking care of my father. And, you know, we have two major hospitals in Los Angeles, and they often send him for surgery to one, but his primary care is at the other one, and there's no transfer of information. And so, you know, he goes to the emergency room, and the emergency room doctor is calling me to find out what his medications are because they can't access the records of the other hospital. And so stuff has been prescribed that contraindicates, you know, and so there's just, if you don't have an advocate who's helping you out as a patient to navigate that whole system, it's very complicated and it's very
accurate. And to know that, that data exists in a digital format that could be so easily accessible and not be able to get it actually makes things worse in a sense.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So how is compassion related to burnout?
So one of the drivers, let me put it a different way. So compassion, if you think of burnout, it's also empathic distress is one synonym for burnout. And another synonym for empathic distress is compassion fatigue, where you've sort of given so much that you don't have anything left to give. And it's that idea of trying to give from an empty well. And so compassion, it turns out, number one, is contagious. So the more compassion there is, the more compassion that's generated. But when one runs out of compassion, or one's ability to generate compassion has run out, that's where the depersonalization and the emotional exhaustion come in. And even the lack of personal accomplishment is, in a sense, a reflection of the lack of compassion for oneself and the work that one has done. When I see someone who is suffering and I have a desire to alleviate that suffering, that, in a sense, is compassion. Right. And So organizations, it turns out, are very effective at extinguishing compassion. Compassion is a normal human response to the recognition of suffering in another human being, but it is not the normal response of an organization, because organizations are not human. And so we really have to make a concerted effort to try to make organizations compassionate, so that as they deal with the humans within their system, both those that work for them as well as those that come to them as patients or however they come, that it is a place of compassion, because that is going to be the well from which the providers that work there and the patients who are treated there get their care. And so if you do not feel that compassion, if the compassion is driven out of your providers as a result of the organizational stress within your institution, then you're going to have a tendency to have more burned out providers. And it is so important that that compassion be present in the physician-patient relationship, because without it, there's not trust in both senses, and there's not that understanding. And in fact, I'm probably going to butcher his name, but there's a book called Compassionomics by Trichick and Mazzarelli that talks about the economic benefits of compassion and how it actually is the best thing financially for the health of an organization, because of how it impacts patient adherence to medication regimens and to prescriptive protocols, how it affects the quality of care, and everything flows really from that physician-patient relationship. And it's actually as important to the physician to have a compassionate relationship as it is to the patient. We always talk about the patient because we want patient-centric care, which I think is appropriate, but not caring for the provider, and that is a huge mistake.
I love the distinction. Yeah, I love your distinction that, you know, organizations are not human, and therefore they don't inherently have compassion. You have to, that speaks to culture of the organization, right? You have to be intentional about that.
Right, and I don't believe that organizations are inherently evil. They're just not human. And so, like you said, we have to be intentional and really try to cultivate that awareness of how we're interacting and treating one another and what the work we're asking people to do requires. And I think, as you alluded to earlier, when you were walking through the hospital yesterday, we are trained in medicine, have been trained to put the mission above everything else. And in a certain respect, that's totally appropriate. But there has to be a place for me recognizing that if I do not care for myself and have proper boundaries and do the things like eat, sleep, get proper exercise, nutrition, rest, and emotional health, that I'm not going to have a well that is capable of running forever without running dry.
Yeah, and this reminds me of, I don't know if you've read Jill Boaty Taylor's book on her book, My Stroke of Insight. I think it's Stroke of Insight. She had a stroke. She's a brain scientist. And she had a stroke, and she was able to witness herself having the stroke and losing brain function. And then it took her 8 years to regain language function, to be practicing medicine again. And she talked about being in the hospital and having no reference for, you know, mother, right? She had lost all that verbal ability. And this woman walks in and gets into bed with her and puts her arms around her and says, I'm your mother. And she says, she makes this connection of mother is a loving, compassionate, you know, but then the nurse came in and just put her tray of food down and walked out and didn't greet her because she thought she wasn't there. And so she talked about just that spiritual experience when she didn't have words and she didn't have language, of really feeling that compassion around the different people who were caring for her, and how that compassion helped her heal.
I have not read that book, but did she do a TED Talk?
She did, yeah.
I believe I've seen her TED Talk,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, very powerful. Yeah,
she was very, very powerful.
Yeah, so it speaks to all of that.
It's important to remember when we care for people about that, and, you know, even going to, you know, having anesthesia and surgery, what goes on in the room as someone is, you know, going to sleep, I think is very important.
Right. What patients hear you say. Yeah. So how did this work for you personally? How did you nurture that compassion for yourself and learn to do that so that you could have this balance back?
Well, I think to a degree that, you know, I talk about burnout being sort of something you can waft into and waft out of. It's not something you ever cure. It's a dilemma that we try to mitigate as much right. as anything, because I think I can be really healthy and then something happens and the next thing I know, I feel like I'm down the tunnel, if you will. So, but in essence, I think if you, we call them the humanities for a reason, because I think they help to keep us human. And so things like listening to and performing music, art, being in nature, those activities that, you know, may not seemingly have a purpose, but we enjoy doing that. You know, most people, if you ask them to name two or three activities that really feed their emotional well-being or feed their soul, they're going to be able to tell you what those are. And so it was really about me taking, you know, that time off and being able to reconnect with, you know, what are the things that really I find pleasure in and make me feel alive, and, you know, carving out time to make those really important parts of my days and weeks so that I can feel joy and also recognize, I think we tend to think of some emotions as bad emotions and some emotions as good emotions. You know, I've been guilty of that. You know, anger is a bad emotion. Well, rage is a bad emotion, and, you know, that anger to that extent, but anger really tells us what we care about.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, if something happens and I'm not angry, that means I'm apathetic, which is worse than being angry about
right.
it. So
right.
I think having a healthy emotional relationship with your feelings is really important. And that's where I think, you know, things like mindfulness, yoga, meditative stances have really been important for me, not so much because I think it's a magic cure, but it has really helped my self-awareness in the moment. When I become angry, I'm able to say, well, what am I angry about? What has hurt my feelings? What, you know, matters to me in this moment, and not displace the anger,
right?
But try to, you know, make a correction in a more healthy way.
And what you're really speaking about is awareness, which you get from those practices, right? Really
yes.
having that presence and that awareness.
Yeah. And a lot of physicians, and I think rightfully so, because what, if you tell them, well, what you need to do to address burnout is to go to a yoga class, do mindfulness meditation, exercise well, sleep, they hear that it's their fault. That and it is absolutely not, you know, if it's an it's a fundamental attribution error to ascribe things to an individual when it's an organizational issue. And so it's an organizational issue, but there are things you can do to help yourself in the midst of that milieu. And it isn't just about doing 10 minutes of mindfulness. It's about what tools that gives you in terms of, like you say, awareness in the present moment to be able to utilize when the time comes, that you can step, in a sense, outside of yourself
right.
and say, this is what's really happening. I'm not going to yell at the nurse or the scrub
right.
tech or the PT person because it's not their fault. This is what the real issue is.
Right, right. So, what kind of things do you recommend for individual doctors to do in order to avoid burnout or to manage work-related stress?
So, you know, we were just talking about mindfulness, yoga, and meditation, and I've had some people who have been reluctant to try mindfulness meditation, which Jon Kabat-Zinn popularized. You know, he wrote the book, Wherever You Go, There You Are.
Right.
And
right.
He really, I think he would say that he's taken the Buddhism out of the Buddhist meditative philosophy. And I would say that in a sense, what you really have, he figured out, is that you can be a Buddhist Catholic or a Buddhist Methodist or a Buddhist Christian, if you will, whatever. It isn't anything for anyone to be afraid of in a spiritual sense. It's really about getting in touch with who you are, and stillness and quiet in a way that allows you to be present in the moment in a non-judgmental way. And that awareness is really important for, I think, healthy emotional functioning, particularly in a stressful environment. So I think that to me is primary, and yoga helps that as well. Sleep is incredibly important. And there's so many of us physicians in medicine who just do not get the amount of sleep we need. And that's a problem with America, but it's really a problem in medicine. Yeah. And call doesn't make that worse. If you work more then 60 hours a week, your risk of burnout goes up astronomically for every extra hour you work. So, and wow. A lot of physicians routinely are in the 60, 80 per hour work week. Nutrition is important. You know, if you're going to fast food restaurants and eating highly processed food, I think there's a plethora of data that suggests that that is not going to be the best for both your physical and mental health and awareness. And then proper boundaries. You know, there are times when we could say no and not add an extra activity that's going to be stressful, but knowing where to draw those and how, I think, is really important.
How has your journey affected how you practice when you're intersecting with patients and other professionals?
I think that it would be hard to argue that you're not a better physician by being a better human being. And so I felt like, to some degree, I am more present in the, particularly in the office when I'm seeing patients preoperatively, and more aware of their feelings and their questions. I think I'm a lot more patient than I used to be. Because of what I've experienced. And then there are times when I feel like that awareness that I have is better, which makes me, I think, a better physician. As I said, it isn't like somebody flipped a switch and now I'm, you know, amazingly well. And there are times when I feel like I lose it a little bit and aren't the best, the best version of myself that I could be. But I think that's part of the process, is recognizing and giving yourself, you know, okay, I didn't do so well in that one. I'm going to do better next time. And that's where the self-compassion comes in, is not being so judgmental against myself that it makes it harder for me to be better the next time.
Right. And looking at it from the other side, what advice do you have for patients and families who are accessing the healthcare system, knowing that they might be seeing a doctor who's suffering from burnout?
Well, as we talked about before, I think the compassion and the physician-patient relationship is so important, that, you know, you recognize and see your physician in a sense. Yeah, he's highly trained. He's expert at what he does, but he's also a human being and deserves the respect and compassion that another human being deserves. He's not an automaton or a superhero, for that matter. And I'd encourage people to be bold about discussing issues with their doctors, whether they're complaints or good things. Or I had a patient, this was a year or so ago, I walked in and I'd had a particularly difficult call night the night before. And I walked in and they go, "How are you doing today? You look really tired," you know, and it just, you know, it's like, well, I had a bad call night. I am really tired. But those kind of things, you know, they create an understanding between people that, wow, you recognize that I'm not on my A game and it's maybe not my fault today. So I think that's important, because as we talked about, the emphasis has been on patient-centered, and I'm not suggesting we make it physician-centered. I'm just saying, recognizing that your physician is a human being, I think, is really important towards developing the relationship where that trust exists and is better for everyone.
And, you know, as you know, I work in behavioral health and mostly in autism services, and we have a huge issue with provider burnout, mostly with our frontline workers who are in families' homes every day, 5-6 days a week, working for 2 to 3, 5 hours. You know, with a young child who has autism, often exhibiting very challenging behaviors, huge amounts of parental stress. And so we have very high rates of attrition in our industry. Do you have any advice for that younger generation? You know, we're talking about these are individuals typically between the ages of 19 and probably 30, but mostly probably 19 to 25 who are doing these direct services and, you know, are just suffering from huge amounts of burnout.
Right. So obviously burnout is not limited to medical professionals. As we alluded to earlier, the corporate rate of burnout, I think, is in the low 30s for CEOs and CFOs. And so there's stress in all organizations. And I think seeing an attrition rate like that would make me think that there is something, you know, as in terms of process or selection that needs to be addressed in terms of maybe just as simple as making the people who are going to be doing that work aware that it is very stressful. I have a slide in one of my presentations from when I was in Kenya of zebras at a watering hole. And I was about 300 yards away. And when I clicked the button to take the shot on my camera, all 15 zebras like scattered out of the water just as quickly as they could, because they know that the watering hole is a dangerous place to be. And so they're on edge and very aware. You know, the savanna is a dangerous place. And I think making workers aware that, hey, you're picking a profession, you're going into a job that is highly stressful, and here are the things that we think can help you mitigate that stress. And we're going to do what we can to support you, and you know, maybe having coaches or things available where they can, you know, vent and talk about the things that have stressed them out and how to process that in a way that is appropriate. Maybe a mentor or mentee program for those who have are in the game for the long haul can help those who are coming along and saying, hey, I see, you know, you had a tough time, you know, with this client or patient today. You know, let me tell you what happened and how I dealt with that when that kind of thing happened with me. Just knowing that you're not alone in that and that your feelings are valid, I think makes a big difference. But you've got to make sure you're caring for yourself. And, you know, in the airplane, when you get ready to take off, the stewardess says, you know, if the oxygen mask drops down, you're traveling with a child or someone who can't assist themselves, put your oxygen mask on yourself first and then help them. And I think a lot of us forget to put our oxygen masks on.
Yeah.
Take care of ourselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been really, really interesting. You connected with art. I mean, your book is about finding the beauty in art and how that connected with you. Can you share with our listeners how you connected with the art and how that practice has really helped you?
So there's this phenomenon where I think when someone has been isolated in a sense emotionally, and you know, I sort of tell the story when I'm doing an emergency tracheostomy for someone with an obstructive laryngeal cancer, my emotions do not help me very much. It's really a time where the technical expertise needs to take over, and I put my emotions aside. And I think a lot of us as surgeons tend to, and physicians, put the emotions in a box and we never get them back out. And so the third thing, a piece of art that moved me, was a lot less difficult and maybe scary. It was less scary for me to talk about the emotions I experienced in a painting and what it moved me to feel than talking about my real emotions in a sense on the inside. So it's like, oh yeah, I remember what it's like to feel hurt and to feel lonely and to be afraid. And so it helped me to find myself in a sense, because I could find myself in the painting.
Because
emotions are essentially who we are. It's a reflection of the truth.
I love that. Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jones. This has been really fascinating and interesting. I've learned a lot, and I just love your connection around compassion, both for ourselves and within organizations, and, you know, both ways, doctor to patient, patient to doctor. It's really, been an aha. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you. It's been lovely being here. I appreciate the invitation. It's been good to be with you. So if your listeners want to connect with me, I'm on Twitter at Sean C. Jones, MD, or my website's drseanjones.com.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.